Ladies and gentlemen, it's nice to see you all here. It's particularly nice and a great honour and privilege to introduce to you Judy Fudge, Professor of Law at the University of Victoria and one of the leading writers in labour law, particularly a feminist perspective on labour law. So she's going to get you to think.
Thank you. I'm going to stand up because I can only think while standing, so it's hard for me when I'm writing. I get very tired. Thanks very much, Catherine. I really appreciate the invitation, and I'd like to thank Bob Hebble, who's here and who invited me. I was reminding Bob that 25 years ago, last month, he examined my PhD. So that's one thing if you decide to become an academic. You'll constantly see people throughout your lives. Right? It's really a very good thing. So it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm in the United Kingdom for 6 months, and I'm supposed to be talking about gender and labor law. And I know that many of you are in the labor law course, and you're going to be taking equality. So I actually really wish I'd brought my equalities paper, which was Women Workers, Is Equality Enough? Because of what's happening to the Equalities Act. Death by a thousand little cuts over the past couple of years. And it's really important. So what I'm going to talk about right now is actually, I'm not even going to mention a case or a statute, but I'm going to try and talk about the feminist engagement with labor law over the past 30 years and what's been going and how that shifted. And how what's interesting is that many of the changes in the way all labor lawyers who are academics think about their field share some of the changes that feminists have gone through, even though there's not much of a dialogue between the two groups, which has to do with massive changes in the labor market. Okay, so what I've tried in this paper is I've tried to reconstruct the main themes and debates that is threaded through the feminist engagement with labor law in the Anglo-American literature over the past 30 years. And I've looked at the feminist project. And a feminist project, Joanne Conahan has written a lot about feminist engagements with labor law. And she identifies three criteria. What makes it feminist rather than something else? So one is that it looks at gendered accounts of the social world, the relationship between men and women, and how we think about sex, transgender, gay, lesbian, those kinds of issues in the social world, and what law has to do about it in the world of work. Second, feminist work focuses on disadvantage and change. And thirdly, it places women at the center. Now, that may become increasingly controversial as the labor market changes dramatically. Okay. So that's what makes it feminist. What makes it labor law? That's hard, actually. And there's a huge and growing literature about what makes labor law labor law. It's clearly a lot of contract, a bunch of tort, a huge amount of property law, and then all of these specific types of legislation. What is labor law? When does it become the law of charities organizing volunteers? So that distinction, labor law from other areas of law, is highly contested, and many people argue it's not a conceptual analytic distinction, but it's an ideological political distinction. So I'm going to look at how labor law is shifting. And I think what's clear is that feminists have been at the forefront of shifting our notions of labor law. And then there's a question, if we shift our notions of labor law so broadly, what's the normative purview of the subject? What are the key issues? And the fun thing that I want to talk is basically about methodology. If you're going to talk about, you know, feminist engagements with labor law, and particularly feminist theoretical engagements, one of the things that's really a problem is that people were particularly theoretical initially. So how do you think about theory in that way? So what I've tried to do is identify what were the theoretical debates underneath the issues and reconstruct the debates in a historical context. because I tend to think history really matters in understanding, that you can't really understand the debate unless you know the historical and political context in which it's emerged. So what I argue from this reconstruction from the 70s onwards is that we've seen three big conceptual shifts in the feminist literature on employment and labor law. The first is from looking at women as a unified object or category of analysis to looking at gender as a constructed and contested, differentiated social relationship. And that's a major shift. The second shift is from looking at the employment relationship, which is really narrow, especially in the United Kingdom. It doesn't get more narrower than in the United Kingdom. It's much broader in other common law jurisdictions, even the United States. So there's a shift from employment as the kind of social field that we're looking at to work generally, but then that becomes really, really, really broad. And then I think the third conceptual shift is how we think of law. It was easy when we thought of law as an instrument and we could just use that instrument and good things would happen. We don't think about law in that way anymore because we've seen that instrumental uses of law have backfiring effects, unintended consequences. You try and do something good, something worse happens. So instead of seeing law as an instrument, now people are seeing it more as a discourse that's highly attracted to state power, but operates within fields of other normative discourses and social orderings. And that it's not as easy to figure out what the consequences of legal interventions are going to be. So those are the three shifts, I argue, that we can see if we reconstruct the feminist theorizing around labor law in a historical context. In the paper, what I do is I divide the history into two categories, two phases, the 70s and the 80s, and then the 90s and on. And the questions of the 1990s are the questions that are really recurring dilemmas or conundrums or paradoxes that we're still trying to resolve. And you'll see this over and over again in just looking at labor law doctrine. And then if we try and stand back and think of how do we understand this doctrine, they arise. So if we look at the 70s and the 80s, the literature in the labor law really emerged in the United States. And then it spread to the United Kingdom, Canada. But it was a focal concern in the United States. And it mostly was really discrimination law. And it looked at women's equality to men. So it looked at occupational discrimination. Why are women always in the low-paid jobs at the bottom of the hierarchy? Why do men do different jobs? Why do women receive lower pay even when they do the same job? Why do women get fired when they have kids? It was all those kinds of questions. And the question was, and it was a really instrumental idea of law, how can we make things better for women? And there were two competing approaches. And I think the two competing approaches had to do with the topic that you were thinking about. So if you were concerned about women being fired when they became pregnant, you were concerned about women's difference from men and how to accommodate their difference. And you were mostly concerned about how to stop women getting fired when they got pregnant, because it was perfectly legal to fire women for being pregnant in most jurisdictions until the mid-60s. And then the question was, okay, so you don't fire them, but they can get their jobs back, but how are they supposed to survive when they're on leave? So what's the income replacement scheme? So the focus there really was around difference and how to deal with women's difference. This ran into problems with lawyers, feminist lawyer, who were concerned about how men were and women were not being treated the same. Men and women doing the same jobs, not getting the same pay. They thought we should be focusing on how women do the same stuff as men and treating women, saying we want equality. Don't focus on difference. If you focus on difference, women will always be disadvantaged. Focus on similarity. So this became the kind of sameness-difference dilemma. Carol Pateman, an American political theorist, called it the Wollstonecraft dilemma. Right? And it's been a recurring idea. So if you, the problem is if you try and treat women exactly the same as men, then what happens with all this extra work that women do in the home and childbearing responsibilities? So that became the kind of issues. And there really was a dilemma, and feminists were stuck on the horns of the dilemma, and they started fighting each other. Until Catherine MacKinnon came around, and believe it, she actually made things better for a short period instead of arguing with everyone. And she said, look, instead of seeing the problem with women and how, you know, whether women conform to the male standard or not, what we should look at is how law, instead of seeing law as a neutral instrument, we should see how law constructs norms of ideal workers, which in turn reinforces disadvantage. So that was the first shift from law as an instrument to law as discursive. So the concern to unmask the male perspective in law became really important in the 1990s. And Sandra Fredman's Women and the Law, published in 1996, was probably the key text on doing this. And it exemplifies all the best characteristics of that scholarship. She examined the social reality of women's lives and contrasted it with the idealized male worker. And she did it on the whole life course from giving birth to retirement, and she looked at it in a historical context. So it really is an important accomplishment. And her book exemplifies the threefold shift in the theoretical commitments of feminist and labor law scholarship, from women to gender, from employment to work, and from an instrumental view of law to one that saw it as ideological and institutional. And what she really focused was on how women's responsibility for all the unpaid work that occurs in the household, without which things would grind to a halt because babies have big floppy heads and need constant care, and it's really expensive to take care of them for the first couple of years, as we see the debate about childminders and the press all the time now. She looked at how those responsibilities in the household and in the family really shaped how women could engage in the labor market, and that the labor market actually excluded all that unpaid but absolutely crucial socially necessary work from value within the labor market. It was family law or welfare law or something, you know, not really earned law. So she looked at this and she tried to think about how you could distribute unpaid work more equitably between men and women. So not looking at how women can become more equal simply in the world of work, but that can't happen unless men become more equal in the world of unpaid work. So we also see at that time a real change in the labor market. From what was good jobs, standard full-time, with good wages, and the recent Roundtree resolution reports confirm this, to a real decline in median-level wages, and the proliferation of own-account employment, zero contract hours, temporary agency work. So as more women come into the labor market, more jobs are really quite bad jobs.
So we have this feminization of the labor market, more jobs that are traditionally like women's jobs, and more women in the labor market. So that starts shifting how general labor lawyers are, and it's also a big shift. Unionization starts really tanking in the United Kingdom from 79 on with Margaret Thatcher. And we have a shift from collective solutions in manufacturing, where there's highly dominant trade unions, to individualized rights. And the United Kingdom embracing Europe in the late 1970s moves us further along in a quality perspective to labor law, away from a collective trade unionist perspective to labor law. Feminist labor law scholarship in the 1990s was much more explicitly theoretical than it had been. And feminists started being concerned about not just the woman, but how different social relations of inequality, migrant status, ethnicity, race, age, influence. So notions of intersectionality became really important. Multiple discrimination, that provision in the Qualities Act that the coalition government won't enact. Right? So the ways to see how interlocking, so that away from the idea of one woman to differently situated women, which makes equality law much more difficult and makes understanding things much more difficult. The second thing that changes is we start seeing that the number of employees in the labor market is radically shrinking. And the United Kingdom, Canada, and Germany in the 1990s had huge growth in self-employment, but self-employment where the self-employed hired no other employees and were way poorer than employees. And Canada was one of the biggest growth, and a secular increase in self-employment, which is also traced to lower productivity increases in Canada. But once you see self-employment growing and all these workfare programs, volunteerism, unpaid internships, so this is growing massively while employment is shrinking. So people started shifting to the law of the labor market, Simon Deacon's work, and away from the law of the employment relationship. So we broadened our conception of work, and where feminists, I think, made their own contribution is by characterizing all that unpaid, socially necessary work as absolutely crucial for a labor market. They actually theorized the supply and saw the supply of labor, children, daily and generational reproduction, as crucial to understanding how labor market functions, and not something that just happened naturally in families. Right? It depended on levels of wages, benefits for pregnancy, all those kinds of things. And then this third shift was really from seeing law as instrumental to law as gendering. In many ways, that was a really good shift because people became much more sophisticated and saw law as constituting the relationship rather than just reflecting and adjusting. But it also, I think, signaled a shift away from law reform activities of feminists to more theoretical kinds of feminism, where you're not actually sitting down with groups and saying, how can we make things better? Or sitting around thinking, how can we think about this better? And the two things are related, but not necessarily entwined. Right? So feminists started thinking more about theorizing law and how to think about that. So to conclude, there are those three shifts, and I think there's a fourth shift that's really emerging now, and I find right now is where I really find it exciting,
is that we can't think of labor law, and feminists can't think of labor law as happening within the nation state. People in the United Kingdom clearly have to think about it as being part of Europe, because all of the directives come from Europe. And there's this huge debate about the United Kingdom's continuing relationship to Europe, mostly around employment laws.
But also when we think of a country like Canada, how we deal with the problem, we have a higher labor force participation rate of women.
We have women working longer hours. The United Kingdom has a really high rate of part-time work. But how we have women working so hard, who's going to take care of the kids? We bring in foreign domestic workers. So we bring in women from the Philippines and India and China to take care of our kids. And of course, they have to be paid lower than the wages that women make, or it wouldn't be affordable. So all of a sudden, you have these relations of what in labor law would be considered exploitation, which is what labor law is concerned about, that are occurring beyond the boundaries of nation states, often between women, that replicate broader international inequalities. So I think the final shift has been looking at migration areas in labor law and seeing not only the family as part of the labor market, but migration policy as absolutely crucial. And you can tell this whenever there's a recession, because the first thing you hear is British jobs for British workers and borders keep going up. And the coalition government is changing the laws around domestic workers being able to migrate, and they're becoming mean. Right? And they're going to have childminders taking care of more children, because you need children, but you have a dilemma. How do you pay for it? Especially if wages are lowering. No one wants to pay taxes. So I think at the end what I'm going to say is that feminists and labor law are really imperialistic. They want labor law to be everything. Migration, tax, social welfare, family law. And the problem is trying to keep the bounds of labor law within a subject that you can teach. Thank you very much.